This is disc number 4.
They came to the corner of Great George Street. Gabriel led them to the right into Birdcage Walk.
Who knows about us in London, Julian? Who knows that you had a professional relationship with Mario?
Isherwood looked up at the dripping trees along the pavement.
Very few people, really. There's Jeremy Crabb over at Bonham's, of course. He's still miffed at you for stealing that Rubens from under his nose.
Isherwood placed a long, bony hand on Gabriel's shoulder.
I have a buyer for it. All I need now is the painting.
I put the varnish on yesterday before I left Jerusalem, Gabriel said. I'll use one of our front shippers to get it here, as quickly as possible. You could have it by the end of the week. By the way, you owe me £150,000.
Checks in the mail, Petal.
Who else? Gabriel asked. Who else knows about us?
Isherwood made a show of thought.
The wretched Oliver Dimbleby, he said. You remember Oliver. I introduced you to him at Green's one afternoon when we were having lunch. A tubby little dealer from King Street tried to buy my gallery out from under me one time.
Gabriel remembered. Somewhere he still had the showy gold-plated business card Oliver had pressed upon him. Oliver had barely looked in Gabriel's direction. Oliver was that way.
I've done many a favor for Crabb over the years, Isherwood said. The sorts of favors we don't like to talk about in our line of work. As for Oliver Dimbleby, I helped him clean up a terrible mess he made with a girl who worked in his gallery. I took the poor waif in, gave her a job. She left me for another dealer. Always do, my girls. What is it about me that drives women away? I'm an easy mark, that's it. Women see that. So did your little outfit. Herr Heller certainly did.
Herr Rudolf Heller, venture capitalist from Zurich, was one of Chamron's favorite aliases. It was the one he had used when recruiting Isherwood.
How is he, by the way?
He sends his best.
Gabriel lowered his eyes to the damp pavement of Birdcage Walk. A breath of cold wind rose from the park. Dead leaves rattled across their path.
I need a Van Gogh, Gabriel said again.
Yes, I heard you the first time. The problem is, I don't have a Van Gogh. In case you've forgotten, Isherwood Fine Arts specializes in old masters. If you want Impressionist, you'll have to look elsewhere.
But you know where I can get one.
Unless you're planning on stealing one, there's nothing on the market right now. At least not that I'm aware of.
But that's not true, is it, Julian? You do know about a Van Gogh. You told me about it once, about 100 years ago. A story about a previously unknown painting your father had seen in Paris between the wars.
Not just my father, Isherwood said. I've seen it too. Vincent painted it in Auvers during the final days of his life. There's a rumor it might have been his undoing. The problem is, the painting isn't for sale, and probably never will be. The family has made it clear to me they'll never part with it. They're also bound and determined to keep its very existence a secret.
Tell me the story again.
I don't have time now, Gabriel. I have a 10:30 appointment at the gallery.
Cancel your appointment, Julian. Tell me about that painting.
Isherwood crossed the footbridge over the lake and headed toward his gallery in St. James's. Gabriel shoved his hands a little deeper into his coat pockets and followed after him.
Ever cleaned him? Isherwood asked.
Vincent? Never. How much do you know about his final days?
About what everyone knows, I suppose.
Bollocks, Gabriel, don't try to play the fool with me. Your brain is like the Grove Dictionary of Art.
It was the summer of 1890, wasn't it?
Isherwood gave a professorial nod of his head.
Please continue.
After Vincent left the asylum in Saint-Remy, he came to Paris to see Theo and Johanna. He visited several galleries and exhibits and stopped at Père Tanguy's artist supply store to check on some canvases he had in storage there. After 3 days, he began to get restless, so he boarded a train for Auvers-sur-Oise, about 20 miles outside of Paris. He thought Auvers would be ideal, a quiet country setting for his work but still close to Theo, his financial and emotional lifeline. He took a room above Café Ravoux and placed himself in the care of Dr. Paul Gachet. Gabriel took Isherwood's arm, and together they darted through an opening in the traffic on the mall and entered the Marlborough Road. He started painting immediately. His style, like his mood, was calmer and more subdued. The agitation and violence that characterized much of his work at Saint-Remy and Arles were gone. He was also incredibly prolific. In the 2 months Vincent stayed in Auvers, he produced more than 80 paintings. A painting a day, some days two. They turned into King Street. Gabriel stopped suddenly. Ahead of them, waddling along the pavement toward the entrance of Christie's auction house, was Oliver Dimbleby. Isherwood turned suddenly into Bury Street and picked up where Gabriel had left off.
When Vincent wasn't at his easel, he could usually be found in his room above Café Ravoux or at the home of Gachet. Gachet was a widower with 2 children, a boy of 15 and a daughter who turned 21 during Vincent's stay in Auvers.
Marguerite. Isherwood nodded.
She was a pretty girl and happened to bear a striking resemblance to one of Vincent's favorite models, the Dutch peasant girl named Steen. She was also deeply infatuated with Vincent. She agreed to pose for him, unfortunately without her father's permission. Vincent painted her in the garden of the family home, dressed in a white gown.
Marguerite Gachet in the garden, Gabriel said.
And when her father found out, he was furious.
But she posed for him again.
Correct, Isherwood said. The second painting is Marguerite Gachet at the piano. In that work, she's wearing a romantic pink ankle-length gown. She also appears in Undergrowth with 2 Figures. It's a deeply symbolic work. The 2 figures are a man and a woman. The man is wearing a top hat and formal suit, and the trees are represented in a manner that makes them appear like vaulted columns of a cathedral. Some have interpreted the image as a prophecy of Vincent's own death. I believe that's incorrect. I believe it's Vincent and Marguerite walking down the aisle, Vincent's premonition of marriage.
But there was a 4th painting of Marguerite.
Marguerite Gachet at her dressing table, said Isherwood. It's the best of the lot by far. Only a handful of people have ever seen it, or even know it exists. Vincent painted it a few days before his death, and then it disappeared.
They walked to Duke Street, then slipped through a narrow passageway into a brick quadrangle called Mason's Yard. Isherwood's gallery occupied an old Victorian warehouse in the far corner, wedged between the offices of a minor Greek shipping company and a pub that was inevitably filled with pretty office girls who rode motor scooters. Isherwood started across the yard toward the gallery, but Gabriel snared his lapel and pulled him in the opposite direction. As they strolled the perimeter through the cold shadows, Isherwood talked of Vincent's death.
On the evening of July 27th, Vincent returned to Café Ravoux in obvious pain and struggled up the stairs to his room. Madame Ravoux followed after him and discovered he'd been shot. She sent for a doctor. The doctor, of course, was Gachet himself. He decided to leave the bullet in Vincent's abdomen and summoned Theo to Auvers. When Theo arrived the following morning, he found Vincent sitting up in bed, smoking his pipe. He died later that day.
They came into a patch of brilliant sunshine. Isherwood shaded his eyes with his long hand.
There are many unanswered questions about Vincent's suicide. It's not clear where he got the gun or the precise place where he shot himself. There are questions, too, about his motivation. Was his suicide the culmination of his long struggle with madness? Was he distraught over a letter he'd just received from Theo, suggesting that Theo could no longer afford to support Vincent along with his own wife and child? Did Vincent take his own life as part of a plan to make his work relevant and commercially viable? I've never been satisfied with any of those theories. I believe it has to do with Gachet, more to the point with Dr. Gachet's daughter.
They slipped into the shadows of the yard once more. Isherwood lowered his hand.
The day before Vincent shot himself, he had gone to Gachet's house. The two quarreled violently, and Vincent threatened Gachet with a gun. What was the reason for the argument? Gachet later claimed that it had something to do with a picture frame, of all things. I believe it was over Marguerite. I think it's possible it had something to do with Marguerite Gachet at a dressing table. It's an exquisite work, one of Vincent's better portraits. The pose and the setting are clearly representative of a bride on her wedding night. Its significance would not have been lost on a man like Paul Gachet. If he'd seen the painting, and there's no reason to believe he didn't, he would have been incensed. Perhaps Gachet told Vincent that marriage to his daughter was out of the question. Perhaps he forbade Vincent ever to paint Marguerite again. Perhaps he forbade Vincent ever to see Marguerite again. What we do know is that Marguerite Gachet wasn't present at Vincent's funeral, though she was spotted the next day tearfully placing sunflowers on his grave. She never married, lived as something of a recluse in Auvergne until her death in 1949. They passed the entrance to Isherwood's gallery and kept walking. After Vincent's death, his paintings became the property of Theo. He arranged for a shipment of the works Vincent had produced at Auvergne and stored them at Père Tanguy's in Paris. Theo, of course, died not long after Vincent, and the paintings became the property of his wife Johanna. None of Vincent's other relatives wanted any of his work. Johanna's brother thought them worthless and suggested they be burned. Isherwood stopped walking. Can you imagine? He propelled himself forward again with a long stride. Johanna catalogued the inventory and worked tirelessly to establish Vincent's reputation. It's because of Johanna that Vincent van Gogh is regarded as a great artist. But there's a glaring omission in her list of Vincent's known works. Marguerite Gachet at her dressing table. Precisely, said Isherwood. Was it an accident or intentional? We'll never know, of course, but I have a theory. I believe Johanna knew that the painting may have contributed to Vincent's death. Whatever the case, it was sold for a song from the storeroom at Père Tanguy's within a year or so of Vincent's death, and never seen again. Which is where my father enters the story. They completed their first circuit of the yard and started a second. Isherwood's pace slowed as he began to talk of his father. He was always a Berliner at heart. He would have stayed there forever. That wasn't possible, of course. My father saw the storm clouds coming and didn't waste any time getting out of town. By the end of 1936, we'd left Berlin and moved to Paris. He looked at Gabriel. Too bad your grandfather didn't do the same thing. He was a great painter, your grandfather. You come from a good bloodline, my boy. Gabriel quickly changed the subject. Your father's gallery was on Rue de la Boétie, wasn't it? Of course, Isherwood replied. The Rue de la Boétie was the center of the art world at that time. Paul Rosenberg had his gallery at number 21. Picasso and Olga lived on the other side of the courtyard at number 23. Georges Wildenstein, Paul Guillaume, Josse Hessel, Etienne Bignou, everyone was there. Isakovitz Fine Arts was next door to Paul Rosenberg's. We lived in an apartment above the exposition rooms. Picasso was my Uncle Pablo. He used to let me watch him paint, and Olga would give me chocolates until I was sick. Isherwood permitted himself a brief smile, which faded quickly as he resumed the story of his father in Paris. The Germans came in May 1940 and started looting the place. My father rented a chateau in Bordeaux on the Vichy side of the line and moved most of his important pieces there. We followed him soon after. The Germans crossed over into the unoccupied zone in 1942, and the roundups and deportations began. We were trapped. My father paid a pair of Basque shepherds to take me over the mountains to Spain. He gave me some documents to carry with me, a professional inventory and a couple of diaries. It was the last time I ever saw him. A horn sounded loudly in Duke Street.
squadron of pigeons burst into flight over the shadowed yard. It was years before I got around to reading the diaries. In one of them I found an entry about a painting my father had seen in Paris one night at the home of a man named Isaac Weinberg. Marguerite Gachet at her dressing table. Weinberg told my father he'd bought the painting from Johanna not long after Vincent's death, and had given it to his wife as a birthday gift. Apparently Mrs. Weinberg bore a resemblance to Marguerite. My father asked Isaac whether he would be willing to sell. Isaac said he wasn't. He asked my father not to mention the painting to anyone, and my father was all too happy to oblige him. Isherwood's mobile phone chirped. He ignored it. In the early 70s, right before I met you, I was in Paris on business. I had a few hours to kill between appointments and decided to look up Isaac Weinberg. I went to the address in the Marais that was listed in my father's notebooks, but Weinberg wasn't there. He hadn't survived the war. But I met his son, Mark, and told him about the entry in my father's notes. He denied the story at first, but finally relented and allowed me to see the painting after swearing me to eternal secrecy. It was hanging in his daughter's bedroom. I asked whether he might be interested in parting with it. He refused, of course. You're certain it's Vincent? Without a doubt. And you haven't been back since. Monsieur Weinberg made it quite clear the painting would never be for sale. I didn't see the point. Isherwood stopped walking and turned to face Gabriel. All right, Petal, I've told you the story. Now suppose you tell me what this is all about. I need that Van Gogh, Julian. Whatever for. Gabriel took Isherwood's sleeve and led him toward the door of the gallery. There was an intercom panel next to the glass door, with four buttons and four corresponding nameplates. One read, Isher, U, Fine, Rs, by appointment only. Isherwood opened the door with a key and led Gabriel up a flight of stairs covered in a time-worn brown carpet. On the landing were two more doors. To the left was a melancholy little travel agency. The owner, a spinster named Miss Archer, was seated at her desk beneath a poster of a happy couple splashing in azure water. Isherwood's door was on the right. His latest secretary, an apologetic-looking creature named Tanya, glanced up furtively as Isherwood and Gabriel came inside. "This is Mr. Klein," said Isherwood. "He'd like to have a look at something upstairs. No interruptions, please. That's a good girl, Tanya, darling." They entered a lift the size of a phone booth and rode it upward, standing so close to one another that Gabriel could smell last night's claret on Isherwood's breath. A few seconds later, the lift shuddered to a stop, and the door opened with a groan. Isherwood's exposition room was in semi-darkness, illuminated only by the mid-morning sun filtering through the skylight. Isherwood settled himself on the velvet-covered divan in the center of the room, while Gabriel led himself on a slow tour. The paintings were nearly invisible in the deep shadows, but Gabriel knew them well. A Venus by Luini, a Nativity by Del Varga, a Baptism of Christ by Bordone, a Luminous Landscape by Claude. Isherwood opened his mouth to speak, but Gabriel raised a finger to his lips and from his coat pocket removed what appeared to be an ordinary Nokia cellular telephone. It was indeed a Nokia mobile phone, but it contained several additional features not available to ordinary customers, such as a GPS beacon and a device that could detect the presence of hidden transmitters. Gabriel toured the room again, this time with his eyes on the display panel of the phone. Then he sat down next to Isherwood, and in a low voice told him why he needed the Van Gogh.
"Zizi, Albakari?" asked Isherwood incredulously. "A bloody terrorist? Are you sure?"
"He's not planting the bombs, Julian. He's not even making the bombs. But he's footing the bill. He's using his business empire to facilitate the movement of the men and material around the globe. In today's world, that's just as bad. Worse. I met him once, but not so he'd remember. Went to a party at his estate out in the Gloucestershire. Huge party. Sea of people. Zizi was nowhere to be found. Came down at the end like Bloody Gatsby. Surrounded by bodyguards, even inside his own home. Strange chap.
Voracious collector, though, isn't he? Art, women, anything money can buy. Predatory, from what I hear. Never had any dealings with him, of course. ZZ's tastes don't run to the old masters. ZZ goes for the impressionists and a bit of other modern stuff. All the Saudis are like that. They don't hold with the Christian imagery of the old masters.
Gabriel sat down next to Isherwood.
He doesn't have a Van Gogh, Julian. He's dropped hints from time to time that he's looking for one. And not just any Van Gogh, he wants something special. From what I hear, he buys very carefully. He spends buckets of money, but he does it wisely. He's got a museum-quality collection, but I didn't realize it was sans Van Gogh.
His art advisor is an Englishman named Andrew Malone. Know him?
Unfortunately, Andrew and I are well acquainted. He has burrowed his way deeply into ZZ's pockets. Spends holidays on ZZ's yacht. Big as the bloody Titanic, from what I hear. Andrew is as slippery as they come. Dirty, too.
In what way?
He's taking it on both ends, Petal.
What do you mean, Julian?
Andrew has an exclusive agreement with ZZ, which means he's not supposed to take money from any other dealer or collector. It's the way big boys like ZZ ensure that the advice they're being given is untainted by any conflicts of interest.
What's Malone up to?
Shakedowns, double commissions, you name it.
You're sure, Julian?
Positive, Petal. Everyone in town knows that in order to do business with ZZ, you have to pay a toll to Andrew Malone.
Isherwood was suddenly off the divan and pacing the length of the exposition room.
So what's your plan, then? Lure ZZ out of his hole with a Van Gogh? Dangle it in front of him and hope he takes it hook, line, and sinker? But there'll be something at the other end of the line, won't there?
One of your agents?
Something like that. And where are you planning to stage this extravaganza? Here, I take it.
Gabriel looked around the room approvingly.
Yes, he said. I think this will do quite nicely.
I was afraid of that.
I need a dealer, Gabriel said. Someone well known in the trade, someone I can trust.
I'm old masters, not impressionists.
It won't matter for a quiet deal like this.
Isherwood didn't argue the point. He knew Gabriel was right.
Have you considered the consequences for moi if your little gambit proves successful? I'll be a marked man. I can deal with the likes of Oliver Dimbleby, but our bloody fucking cater is another thing altogether.
Obviously, we'll have to make some post-operational provisions for your security.
I love your euphemisms, Gabriel. You and Chamron always resort to euphemisms when the truth is too awful to say aloud. They'll put a fatwa on my head. I'll have to close up shop, go into bloody hiding.
Gabriel appeared unmoved by Isherwood's protests.
You're not getting any younger, Julian. You're nearing the end of the road. You have no children, no heirs. Who's going to take over the gallery? Besides, have you taken a moment to calculate your commission on the private sale of a previously unknown Van Gogh? Add to that your earnings on a fire sale of your existing stock. Things could be a lot worse, Julian.
I'm picturing a nice villa in the south of France. A new name, a team of office security boys to look after me in my dotage.
Make sure you have a spare room for me.
Isherwood sat down again.
Your plan has one serious flaw, Petal. It will be easier for you to snare your terrorist than it will be to land that Van Gogh. Assuming it's still in the possession of the Weinberg family, what makes you think they're going to give it up?
Who said anything about giving it up?
Isherwood smiled.
I'll get you the address.
Chapter 14. The Marais, Paris.
You should eat something, said Uzi Narvot.
Gabriel shook his head. He'd eaten lunch on the train from London.
Have the borscht, Navot said. You can't come to Joe Goldenberg and not have the borscht.
Yes, I can, Gabriel said. Purple food makes me nervous.
Navot caught the waiter's eye and ordered an extra-large bowl of borscht and a glass of kosher red wine. Gabriel frowned and looked out the window. A steady rain was drumming against the paving stones of the Rue de Rossier, and it was nearly dark. He had wanted to meet Navot someplace other than the most famous delicatessen in the most visible Jewish district of Paris, but Navot had insisted on Joe Goldenberg, based on his long-held belief that the best place to hide a pine tree was in a forest.
"This place is making me nervous," Gabriel murmured. "Let's take a walk."
"In this weather, forget it. Besides, no one is going to recognize you in that get-up. Even I nearly didn't notice you when you came through the door."
Gabriel looked at the ghostly face reflected in the glass. He wore a dark corduroy flat cap, contact lenses that turned his green eyes to brown, and a false goatee beard that accentuated his already narrow features. He had traveled to Paris on a German passport bearing the name Heinrich Kiefer. After arriving at the Gare du Nord, he'd spent 2 hours walking the Seine embankments, checking his tail for surveillance. In his shoulder bag was a worn volume of Voltaire he'd purchased from a bouquiniste on the Quai Montebello. He turned his head and looked at Navot. He was a heavy-shouldered man, several years younger than Gabriel, with short strawberry-blonde hair and pale blue eyes. In the lexicon of the office, he was a Katza, an undercover field operative and case officer. Armed with an array of languages, a roguish charm, and a fatalistic arrogance, he had penetrated Palestinian terrorist cells and recruited agents in Arab embassies scattered across Western Europe. He had sources in nearly all the European security and intelligence services and oversaw a vast network of Sayanim. He could always count on getting the best table in the grill room at the Ritz in Paris because the maître d'hôtel was a paid informant, as was the chief of the maid staff. He was dressed now in a gray tweed jacket and black roll-neck sweater, for his identity in Paris was one Vincent Lafont, a freelance travel writer of Breton descent who spent most of his time living out of a suitcase. In London, he was known as Clyde Bridges, European marketing director of an obscure Canadian business software firm. In Madrid, he was a German of independent means and a restless soul who idled away the hours in cafes and bars and traveled to relieve the burdens of a restless and complex soul. Navot reached into his briefcase and produced a manila file folder, which he placed on the table in front of Gabriel.
"There's the owner of your Van Gogh," he said. "Have a look."
Gabriel discreetly lifted the cover. The photograph inside showed an attractive middle-aged woman with dark wavy hair, olive skin, and a long aquiline nose. She was holding an umbrella above her head and descending a flight of stone steps in Montmartre.
"Anna Weinberg," Navot said. 44, unmarried, childless. Jewish demographics in microcosm. An only child with no children. At this rate, we won't need a state."
Navot looked down and picked morosely at a bowl of potted chicken and vegetables. He was prone to fits of despondency, especially when it came to the future of the Jewish people.
"She owns a small boutique up in Montmartre on the Rue Lepic. Boutique Lepic is the name of it. I snapped that photo of her earlier this afternoon as she was walking to lunch. One is left with the impression the boutique is more of a hobby than a vocation. I've seen her bank accounts. Mark Weinberg left his daughter very well off."
The waiter approached and placed a bowl of purple dreck in front of Gabriel. He immediately pushed it toward the center of the table. He couldn't bear the smell of borscht. Navot dropped a lump of bread into his broth and prodded it with his spoon.
"Weinberg was an interesting fellow. He was a prominent lawyer here in Paris. He was also something of a memory militant. He brought a great deal of pressure on the government to come clean about the role of the French in the Holocaust. As a result, he wasn't terribly popular in some circles here in Paris."
"And the daughter, what are her politics?"
"Moderate Euro-socialist, but that's no crime in France. She also inherited a bit of militancy from her father. She's involved with a group that's trying to combat the anti-Semitism here. She actually met with the French president once. Look underneath that photograph."
Gabriel found a clipping from a French magazine about the current wave of anti-Semitism in France. The accompanying photograph showed Jewish protesters marching across one of the Seine bridges. At the head of the column, carrying a sign that read, "Stop the Hatred Now," was Hannah Weinberg.
"Has she ever been to Israel?"
"At least 4 times. Shabak is working that end of things to make certain she wasn't sitting up in Ramallah plotting with the terrorists. I'm sure they'll turn up nothing on her. She's golden, Gabriel. She's a gift from the intelligence gods."
"Sexual preferences?"
"Men, as far as we can tell.
She's involved with a civil servant.
Jewish? Thank God.
Have you been inside her flat?
I went in with the Neviot team myself.
Neviot teams specialized in gathering intelligence from hard targets such as apartments, offices, and hotel rooms. The unit employed some of the best break-in artists and thieves in the world. Gabriel had other plans for them later in the operation, provided, of course, Hannah Weinberg agreed to part with her Van Gogh.
Did you see the painting?
Navot nodded.
She kept it in her childhood bedroom.
How did it look?
You want my assessment of a Van Gogh?
Navot shrugged his heavy shoulders.
It's a very nice painting of a girl sitting at a dressing table. I'm not artistic like you. I'm potted chicken and a nice love story at the movies. You're not eating your soup.
I don't like it, Uzi. I told you I don't like it.
Navot took Gabriel's spoon and swirled the dab of sour cream, lightening the hue of the purple mixture.
We had to peek at her papers, Navot said. We rummaged through her closets and drawers. We left a little something on her phone and computer as well. One can never be too careful in a situation like this.
Room coverage?
Navot appeared hurt by the question.
Of course, he said.
What are you using for a listening post?
A van for the moment. If she agrees to help us, we're going to need something more permanent. One of the Neviot boys is already scouting the neighborhood for a suitable flat.
Navot pushed the remnants of his potted chicken to one side and started in on Gabriel's borscht. For all his European sophistication, he was at heart still a peasant from the shtetl.
I can see where this is going, he said between spoonfuls. You get to track down the bad guy, and I get to spend the next year watching a girl. But that's the way it's always been with us, hasn't it? You get all the glory, while the field hands like me do all the spade work. My God, you saved the Pope himself. How's a mere mortal like me supposed to compete with that?
Shut up and eat your soup, Uzi.
Being Chamron's chosen one had not come without a price. Gabriel was used to the professional jealousy of his colleagues.
I have to leave Paris tomorrow, Navot said. I'll be gone only a day.
Where are you going?
Amos wants a word with me.
He paused, then added,
I think it's about the special ops job. The job you turned down.
It made sense, Gabriel thought. Navot was an extremely capable field agent who'd taken part in several major operations, including a few with Gabriel.
Is that what you want, Uzi? A job at Kingsall Boulevard?
Navot shrugged.
I've been out here in the field a long time. Bella wants to get married. It's hard to have a stable home life when you live like this. Sometimes, when I wake up in the morning, I never know where I'm going to wind up at the end of the day. I can have breakfast in Berlin, lunch in Amsterdam, and be sitting in Kingsall Boulevard at midnight briefing the director.
Navot gave Gabriel a conspiratorial smile.
That's what the Americans don't understand about us. They put their case officers into little boxes and slap their wrists when they step outside the lines. The office isn't that way. It never was. That's what makes it the greatest job in the world. And that's why our service is so much better than theirs. They wouldn't know what to do with a man like you.
Navot had lost interest in the borscht. He pushed it across the table so that it looked as though Gabriel had eaten it. Gabriel reached for the glass of wine, but thought better of it. He had a headache from the train ride and the rainy Paris weather, and the kosher wine smelled about as appealing as paint thinner.
But it takes a toll on marriages and relationships, doesn't it, Gabriel? How many of us are divorced? How many of us have had affairs with girls out there in the field? At least, if I'm working in Tel Aviv, I'll be around more often. There's still a lot of travel with the job, but less than this. Bella has a place near the beach in Caesarea. It will be a nice life.
He shrugged again.
Listen to me. I'm acting as though Amos has offered me the job. Amos hasn't offered me anything. For all I know, he's bringing me to Kingsall Boulevard to fire me.
Don't be ridiculous. You're the most qualified man for the job. You'll be my boss, Susie.
Your boss, please. No one is your boss, Gabriel. Only the old man.
Navot's expression turned suddenly grave.
How is he? I hear it's not good.
He's going to be fine, Gabriel assured him.
They lapsed into silence as the waiter came to the table and cleared away the dishes. When he was gone again, Gabriel gave the file folder to Navot, who slipped it back into his briefcase.
So, how are you going to play it with Hannah Weinberg? I'm going to ask her to give up a painting that's worth $80 million. I have to tell her the truth, or at least some version of the truth, and then we'll have to deal with the security consequences. What about the approach? Are you going to dance for a while or go straight in for the kill?
I don't dance, Uzi. I've never had time for dancing.
At least you won't have any trouble convincing her who you are. Thanks to the French security service, everyone in Paris knows your name and your face. When do you want to start?
Tonight.
You're in luck, then.
Navot looked toward the window. Gabriel followed his gaze and saw a woman with dark hair walking down the Rue des Rosiers beneath the shelter of an umbrella. He stood without a word and headed toward the door.
Don't worry, Gabriel, Navot muttered to himself. I'll take care of the check.
At the end of the street, she turned left and disappeared. Gabriel paused on the corner and watched black-coated Orthodox men filing into a large synagogue for evening prayers. Then he looked down the Rue Pavée and saw the silhouette of Hannah Weinberg receding gently into the shadows. She stopped at the doorway of an apartment building and reached into her handbag for the key. Gabriel set out down the pavement and stopped a few feet from her as her hand was outstretched toward the lock.
Mademoiselle Weinberg?
She turned and regarded him calmly in the darkness. Her eyes radiated a calm and sophisticated intelligence. If she was startled by his approach, she gave no sign of it.
You are Hannah Weinberg, are you not?
Yes, she said. What can I do for you, monsieur?
I need your help, Gabriel said. I was wondering whether we might have a word in private.
Are we acquainted, monsieur?
No, said Gabriel.
Then how can I possibly help you?
It would be better if we discussed this in private, mademoiselle.
I don't make a habit of going to private places with strange men, monsieur. Now, if you'll excuse me.
She turned away and raised the key toward the lock again.
It's about your painting, Mademoiselle Weinberg. I need to talk to you about your Van Gogh.
She froze and looked at him again. Her gaze was still placid.
I'm sorry to disappoint you, monsieur, but I don't have a Van Gogh. If you'd like to see some paintings by Vincent, I suggest you visit the Musée d'Orsay.
She looked away again.
Marguerite Gachet at her dressing table, said Gabriel calmly. It was purchased by your grandfather from Theo Van Gogh's widow, Johanna, and given to your grandmother as a birthday present. Your grandmother bore a vague resemblance to Mademoiselle Gachet. When you were a child, the painting hung in your bedroom. Shall I go on?
Her composure disappeared. Her voice, when she spoke again after a moment of stunned silence, was unexpectedly vehement.
How do you know about the painting?
I'm not at liberty to say.
Of course not.
She said this as an insult.
My father always warned me that one day a greedy French art dealer would try to get the painting away from me. It is not for sale, and if it ever turns up missing, I'll make certain to give the police your description.
I'm not an art dealer, and I'm not French.
Then who are you? She asked. And what do you want with my painting?
Chapter 15. The Marais, Paris. The courtyard was empty and dark, lit only by the lights burning in the windows of the apartments above. They crossed it in silence and entered the foyer, where an old-fashioned cage lift stood ready to receive them. She mounted a flight of wide stairs instead and led him up to the fourth floor. On the landing were two stately mahogany doors. The door on the right was absent a nameplate. She opened it and led him inside. Gabriel took note of the fact that she punched the code into the keypad before switching on the lights. Hannah Weinberg, he decided, was good at keeping secrets. It was a large apartment with a formal entrance hall and a library adjoining the sitting room. Antique furniture covered in faded brocade stood sedately about. Thick velvet curtains hung in the windows, and an ormolu clock set to the wrong time ticked quietly on the mantel. Gabriel's professional eye went immediately to the 6 decent oil paintings that hung on the walls. The effect of the decor was to create the impression of a bygone era. Indeed, Gabriel would scarcely have been surprised to see Paul Gachet reading the evening newspapers by gaslight. Hannah Weinberg removed her coat, then disappeared into the kitchen. Gabriel used the opportunity to look inside the library. leather-bound legal volumes lined formal wooden bookcases with glass doors. There were more paintings here, prosaic landscapes, a painting of a man on horseback, the obligatory sea battle, but nothing that suggested the owner might also be in possession of a lost Van Gogh. He returned to the sitting room as Hannah Weinberg emerged from the kitchen with a bottle of Sancerre and two glasses. She handed him the bottle and a corkscrew and watched his hands carefully as he removed the cork. She was not as attractive as she had appeared in Uzi Novot's photograph. Perhaps it had been a trick of the nickeled Parisian light. Or perhaps almost any woman looked attractive descending a flight of steps in Montmartre. Her pleated wool skirt and heavy sweater concealed what Gabriel suspected was a somewhat chunky figure. Her eyebrows were very wide and lent a profound seriousness to her face. Seated as she was now, surrounded by the dated furnishings of the room, she looked much older than her 44 years.
"I'm surprised to see you in Paris, Monsieur Allon. The last time I read your name in the newspaper, you were still wanted for questioning by the French police."
"I'm afraid that's still the case."
"But you still came? Just to see me?"
"Must be very important."
"It is, Mademoiselle Weinberg."
Gabriel filled two glasses with wine, handed one to her, and raised his own in a silent toast. She did the same, then lifted the glass to her lips.
"Are you aware of what happened here in the Marais after the bombing?"
She answered her own question.
"Things were very tense. Rumors were flying that it had been carried out by Israel. Everyone believed it was true, and unfortunately, the French government was very slow to do anything about the situation. Even after they knew, it was all a lie. Our children were beaten in the streets. Rocks were thrown through the windows of our homes and shops. Terrible things were spray-painted on the walls of the Marais and other Jewish neighborhoods. We suffered because of what happened inside that train station."
She gave him a scrutinizing look, as though trying to determine whether he was really the man she had seen in the newspapers and on television.
"But you suffered too, didn't you? Is it true your wife was involved in it?"
The directness of her question surprised Gabriel. His first instinct was to lie, to conceal, to guide the conversation back onto ground of his choosing. But this was a recruitment, and a perfect recruitment, Chamron always said, is at its heart a perfect seduction. And when one was seducing, Gabriel reminded himself, one had to reveal something of oneself.
"They lured me to Gare de Lyon by kidnapping my wife," he said. "Their intention was to kill us both, but they also wanted to discredit Israel and make things unbearable for the Jews of France."
"They succeeded, for a little while, at least." "Don't misunderstand me, Monsieur Arlon. Things are still bad for us here. Just not as bad as they were during those days after the bombing."
She drank some more of the wine, then crossed her leg and smoothed the pleats of her skirt.
"This might sound like a silly question, considering who you work for, but how did you find out about my Van Gogh?"
Gabriel was silent for a moment. Then he answered her truthfully. The mention of Isherwood's visit to this very apartment more than 30 years earlier caused her lips to curl into a vague smile of remembrance.
"I think I remember him," she said. "A tall man, quite handsome, full of charm and grace, but at the same time somehow vulnerable."
She paused, then added,
"Like you."
"Charm and grace are words that are not often applied to me."
"And vulnerability?"
She gave him another slight smile. It served to soften the serious edges of her face.
"All of us are vulnerable to some degree, are we not? Even someone like you? The terrorists found where you were vulnerable and they exploited that. That's what they do best. They exploit our decency, our respect for life. They go after the things we hold dear."
Navot was right, Gabriel thought. She was a gift from the intelligence gods. He placed his glass on the coffee table. Hannah's eyes followed his every movement.
"What happened to this man, Samuel Isakovitz?" she asked. "Did he make it out?"
Gabriel shook his head.
"He and his wife were captured in Bordeaux when the Germans moved south."
"Where did they send them?"
"Sobibor."
She knew what that meant. Gabriel needn't say anything more.
And your grandfather? He said. She peered into her Sancerre for a moment before answering.
Je dis noir, she said. Do you know this term?
Gabriel nodded solemnly. Jeudi Noir, Black Thursday.
On the morning of July 16, 1942, 4,000 French police officers descended on the Marais and other Jewish districts in Paris with orders to seize 27,000 Jewish immigrants from Germany, Austria, Poland, the Soviet Union, and Czechoslovakia. My father and grandparents were on the list. You see, my grandparents were originally from the Lublin district of Poland. The two police who knocked on the door of this very apartment took pity on my father and told him to run. A Catholic family who lived on the floor below took him in, and he stayed there until liberation. My grandparents weren't so lucky. They were sent to the detention camp at Drancy. 5 days after that, a sealed rail car to Auschwitz. Of course, that was the end for them.
And the Van Gogh?
There wasn't any time to make arrangements for it, and there was no one in Paris that my grandfather felt he could trust. It was war, you know. People were betraying each other for stockings and cigarettes. When he heard the roundups were coming, he removed the painting from the stretcher and hid it beneath a floorboard in the library. After the war, it took my father years to get the apartment back. A French family had moved in after my grandparents were arrested, and they were reluctant to give up a nice apartment on the Rue Pavée. Who could blame them?
What year did your father regain possession of the apartment?
It was 1952.
10 years, Gabriel said. And the Van Gogh was still there?
Just as my grandfather had left it, hidden under the floorboards of the library.
Amazing.
Yes, she said. The painting has remained in the Weinberg family for more than a century, through war and Holocaust. And now, you're asking me to give it up.
Not give it up, said Gabriel.
Then what?
I just need to... He paused, searching for the appropriate word. I need to rent it.
Rent it? For how long?
I can't say. Perhaps a month, perhaps 6 months. Maybe a year or longer.
For what purpose?
Gabriel was not ready to answer her. He picked up the cork and used his thumbnail to scratch away a torn edge.
Do you know how much that painting is worth? She asked. If you're asking me to give it up, even for a brief period, I believe I'm entitled to know the reason why.
You are, Gabriel said. But you should also know that if I tell you the truth, your life will never be the same.
She poured more wine for herself and held the glass for a moment against her body without drinking from it.
2 years ago, there was a particularly vicious attack here in the Marais. A young Orthodox boy was set upon by a gang of North Africans as he was walking home from school. They set his hair on fire and carved a swastika into his forehead. He still bears the scar. We organized a demonstration to bring pressure on the French government to do something about the anti-Semitism. As we were marching in the Place de la République, there was an anti-Israel counter-demonstration. Do you know what they were shouting at us?
Death to the Jews.
And do you know what the French president said?
There is no anti-Semitism in France.
My life has never been the same since that day. Besides, as you might have surmised, I'm very good at keeping secrets. Tell me why you want my Van Gogh, Monsieur Allon. Perhaps we can come to some accommodation.
The Neviot surveillance van was parked at the edge of the Parc Royal. Uzi Navot rapped his knuckles twice on the one-way rear window and was immediately admitted. One Neviot man was seated behind the wheel. The other was in the back, hunched over an electronic console with a pair of headphones over his ears.
What's going on? Navot asked.
Gabriel has her in his sights, the Neviot man said, and now he's going in for the kill.
Navot slipped on a pair of headsets and listened while Gabriel told Hannah Weinberg how he was going to use her Van Gogh to track down the most dangerous man in the world. The key was hidden in the top drawer of the writing desk in the library. She used it to unlock the door at the end of the unlit corridor. The room behind it was a child's room. Hannah's room, thought Gabriel, frozen in time. a four-poster bed with lace canopy, shelves stacked with stuffed animals and toys, a poster of an American heartthrob actor, and hanging above a French provincial dresser shrouded in heavy shadow, a lost painting by Vincent van Gogh. Gabriel moved slowly forward and stood motionless before it, right hand on his chin, head tilted slightly to one side. Then he reached out and gently fingered the lavish brushstrokes. They were Vincent's, Gabriel was sure of it. Vincent on fire, Vincent in love. The restorer calmly assessed his target. The painting appeared as though it had never been cleaned. It was covered with a fine layer of surface grime, and there were three horizontal cracks, a result Gabriel suspected of having been rolled too tightly by Isaac Weinberg the night before Judy Noir.
"I suppose we should talk about the money," Anna said. "How much does Julian think it will fetch?"
"In the neighborhood of 80 million. I've agreed to let him keep a 10% commission and as compensation for his role in the operation. The remainder of the money will be immediately transferred to you."
$72 million.
"Give or take a few million, of course."
"And when your operation is over?"
"I'm going to get the painting back."
"How do you intend to do that?"
"Leave that to me, Mademoiselle Weinberg."
"And when you return the painting to me, what happens to the 72 million?
"Give or take a few million, of course." "You may keep any interest accrued. In addition, I will pay you a rental fee. How does $5 million sound?"
She smiled. "It sounds fine. But I have no intention of keeping the money for myself. I don't want their money."
"Then what do you intend to do with it?"
She told him.
"I like the sound of that," he said. "Do we have a deal, Mademoiselle Weinberg?"
"Yes," she said. "I believe we have a deal."
After leaving Hannah Weinberg's apartment, Gabriel went to an office safe flat near the Bois de Boulogne. They watched her for 3 days. Gabriel saw her only in surveillance photographs and heard her voice only in the recordings. Each evening he scoured the tapes for signs of betrayal or indiscretion, but found only fidelity. On the night before she was to surrender the painting, he heard her sobbing softly and realized she was saying goodbye to Marguerite. Navotte brought the painting the next morning, wrapped in an old quilt he had taken from Hannah's apartment. Gabriel considered sending it back to Tel Aviv by courier, but in the end decided to carry it out of France himself. He removed it from the frame, then pried the canvas off the stretcher. As he rolled it carefully, he thought of Isaac Weinberg the night before Judy Noir. This time, instead of being hidden beneath a floorboard, it was tucked securely into the false lining of Gabriel's suitcase. Navotte drove him to the Gare du Nord.
"A Baudel from London Station will be waiting for you at Waterloo," Navotte said. "He'll run you up to Heathrow. El Al is expecting you. They'll make sure you have no problems with your baggage."
"Thanks, Susie. You won't be making my travel arrangements much longer."
"I'm not so sure about that."
"Things didn't go well with Amos?"
"He's hard to read."
"What did he say?"
"He said he needs a few days to think it over."
"You didn't expect him to offer it to you on the spot, did you?"
"I don't know what I expected."
"Don't worry, Uzi, you'll get the job."
Navotte pulled over to the side of the street, a block from the station.
"You put in a good word for me at Kingsall Boulevard, won't you, Gabriel?"
"Amos likes you." "What gave you that impression?"
"I could just tell," he said. "Everyone likes you."
Gabriel climbed out, took his suitcase from the back seat, and disappeared into the station. Navotte waited at the curb until 5 minutes after Gabriel's scheduled departure, then pulled out into the traffic and drove away. The apartment was in darkness when Gabriel arrived. He switched on a halogen lamp and was relieved to see his studio was still intact. Chiara was sitting up in bed as he entered their room. Her hair was newly washed and drawn back from her face by a velvet elastic band. Gabriel removed it and loosened the buttons of her nightgown. The painting lay next to them as they made love.
"You know," she said, "most men just come home from Paris with an Hermès scarf and some perfume."
The telephone rang at midnight. Gabriel answered it before it could ring a second time.
"I'll be there tomorrow," he said a moment later, then hung up the phone.
Who was that?
Kiara asked.
Adrian Carter.
What did he want?
He wants me to come to Washington right away.
What's in Washington?
A girl, said Gabriel. Carter's found the girl.
Chapter 16. McLean, Virginia.
How is the flight?
Eternal.
It's the autumn jet stream patterns, Carter said pedantically. It adds at least 2 hours to flights from Europe to America.
Israel isn't in Europe, Adrian. Israel is in the Middle East.
Really?
You can ask your director of intelligence. He'll clear up the confusion for you.
Carter gave Gabriel a contemptuous look, then returned his eyes to the road. They were driving toward Washington along the Dulles Access Road in Carter's battered Volvo. Carter was wearing a corduroy sports jacket with patches on the elbows. It reinforced his professorial image. All that was missing was the canvas book bag and the NPR coffee mug. He was driving well below the posted speed limit and making repeated glances into his rearview mirror.
Are we being followed? Gabriel asked.
Speed cops, said Carter. They're fanatical on this road.
Any problems at passport control?
None, Gabriel said. In fact, they seemed very happy to see me.
It was something Gabriel had never understood about America, the geniality of their border policemen. He had always found something reassuring in the bored surliness of the Israelis who stamped passports at Ben-Gurion Airport. American customs agents were far too cordial. He looked out the window. They had left the Dulles Access Road and were driving now through McLean. He'd been to Virginia just once before, a brief visit to a CIA safe house deep in the horse country near Middleburg. He found McLean to be an archetypal American suburb, neat and prosperous, but somehow lifeless. They skirted the downtown commercial district, then entered a residential section with large tract homes. The developments had names like Marywood and Colonial Estates. A road sign floated toward them, George Bush Center for Intelligence.
You're not actually thinking about taking me into headquarters, are you?
Of course not, Carter said. We're going into the district.
The district, Gabriel knew, was the way Washingtonians referred to their little village on the Potomac. They crossed a highway overpass and entered an area of rolling hills and dense woods. Gabriel, through the trees, glimpsed great houses overlooking the river.
What's her name?
Sarah Bancroft, Carter replied. Her father was a senior executive in the International Division of Citibank. For the most part, Sarah was raised in Europe. She's comfortable abroad in a way that most Americans aren't. She speaks languages. She knows which fork to use when.
Education?
She came back here for college. Did a bachelor's in art history at Dartmouth, then a stretch at the Courtauld Institute of Art in London. I take it you're familiar with the Courtauld?
Gabriel nodded. It was one of the world's most prestigious schools of art. Its graduates included an art dealer from St. James's named Julian Isherwood.
After the Courtauld, she did her doctorate at Harvard, Carter said. Now she's a curator at the Phillips Collection in Washington. It's a small museum near...
I know the Phillips Collection, Adrian.
Sorry, Carter said earnestly. A large white-tailed deer darted from the trees and crossed their path. Carter let his foot off the gas and watched the animal bound silently away through the darkening woods.
Who brought her to your attention? Gabriel asked,
but Carter made no response. He was hunched over the wheel now and scanning the trees along the edge of the road for more deer.
Where there's one, he said, there's usually another.
Just like the terrorists, Gabriel said.
He repeated his question.
She applied to join us a few months after 9/11, Carter said. She just finished her PhD. She looked interesting on paper, so we brought her in and gave her to the psychiatrists and personnel. They put her through the ringer and didn't like what they saw. Too independent-minded, they said. Maybe even a bit too smart for her own good. When we turned her down, she landed at the Phillips.
So you're offering me one of your rejects?
The word hardly applies to Sarah Bancroft.
Carter reached into the pocket of his corduroy blazer and handed Gabriel a photograph. Sarah Bancroft was a strikingly beautiful woman, with shoulder-length blonde hair, wide cheekbones, and large eyes the color of a cloudless summer sky.
How old?
31. Why isn't she married? Carter hesitated a moment. Why isn't she married, Adrian? She had a boyfriend while she was at Harvard, a young lawyer named Ben Callahan. It ended badly. What happened to Ben? He boarded a flight to Los Angeles at Logan Airport on the morning of September 11th, 2001. Gabriel held out the photograph toward Carter. Zizi's not going to be interested in hiring someone touched by 9/11. You brought me here for nothing, Adrian. Carter kept his hands on the wheel. Ben Callahan was a college boyfriend, not a husband. Besides, Sarah never talks about him to anyone. We practically had to beat it out of her. She was afraid Ben's death would follow her around for the rest of her life, that people would treat her like a widow at age 26. She keeps it very much inside. We did some sniffing around for you this week. No one knows. ZZ's security hounds are going to do more than sniff around, Adrian. And if they catch one whiff of 9/11, he's going to run from her as fast as he can. Speaking of ZZ, his house is just ahead. Carter slowed to negotiate a bend. A large brick and iron security gate appeared on their left. Beyond the gate, a long paved drive rose to an enormous faux chateau mansion overlooking the river. Gabriel looked away as they sped past. ZZ will never find out about Ben, Carter said. Are you willing to bet Sarah's life on that? Meet her, Gabriel. See what you think. I already know what I think. She's perfect. So what's the problem? If we make one mistake, ZZ is going to drop her down a very deep hole. That's the problem, Adrian. The suddenness with which they reached the center of Washington took Gabriel by surprise. One moment they were on a two-lane rural road at the edge of the Potomac Gorge. The next they were crawling along Q Street through the Georgetown evening rush. Carter, playing the role of tour guide, pointed out the homes of the neighborhood's most celebrated residents. Gabriel, head against the window, couldn't summon the energy even to feign interest. They crossed a short bridge, guarded at each end by a pair of enormous tarnished buffaloes, and entered the city's diplomatic quarter. Just beyond Massachusetts Avenue, Carter pointed to a turreted red brick structure on the left side of the street. That's the Phillips, he said helpfully. Gabriel looked to his right and saw a bronze version of Mohandas Gandhi hiking across a tiny triangular park. Why Gandhi, he wondered. What did the ideals of the Mahatma have to do with this patch of American global power? Carter drove another block and parked in a restricted diplomatic zone outside a tired-looking Latin American embassy. He left the engine running and made no movement to indicate he intended to get out of the car. This part of town is called DuPont Circle, he said, still in tour guide mode. It's what passes for avant-garde in Washington. An officer of the Secret Service Uniform Division rapped his knuckle on Carter's window and gestured for him to move along. Carter, eyes straight ahead, held his ID against the glass, and the officer walked back to his squad car. A moment later, something caught Carter's attention in the rearview mirror. Here she comes, he said. Gabriel looked out his window as Sarah Bancroft floated virtuously past, dressed in a long dark overcoat with a narrow waist. She held a leather briefcase in one hand, a cell phone in the other. Gabriel heard her voice briefly as she passed, low, sophisticated, a trace of an English accent, a remnant, no doubt, of her time at the Corteau and a childhood spent in international schools abroad. What do you think? Asked Carter. I'll let you know in a minute. She came to the corner of Q Street and 20th Street. On the opposite corner was an esplanade filled with sidewalk vendors and a pair of escalators leading to the DuPont Circle metro station. The traffic light in Sarah's direction was red. Without stopping, she stepped from the curb and started to cross. When a taxi driver sounded his car horn in protest, she shot him a look that could melt ice and carried on with her conversation. Then she continued slowly across the intersection and stepped onto the down escalator. Gabriel watched with admiration as she sank slowly from view. Do you have two more just like her? Carter fished a mobile phone from his pocket and dialed. We're on, he said. A moment later, a large black Suburban rounded the corner and parked illegally on Q Street, adjacent to the escalators. 5 minutes after that, Gabriel saw her again, this time rising slowly out of the depths of the metro station.
She was no longer speaking into her telephone, nor was she alone. Two of Carter's agents were with her, a man and a woman, one on each arm in case she had a sudden change of heart. The back door of the Suburban swung open, and Sarah Bancroft vanished from sight. Carter started the engine and headed back to Georgetown. Chapter 17. Georgetown. The black Suburban came to a stop 15 minutes later outside a large federal-style townhouse on N Street. As Sarah mounted the curved red brick steps, the door opened suddenly and a figure appeared in the shadows of the portico. He wore creaseless khaki trousers and a corduroy blazer with patches on the elbow. His gaze had a curious clinical detachment that reminded Sarah of the grief counselor she'd seen after Ben's death. "I'm Carter," he said, as if the thought had occurred to him suddenly. He didn't say whether it was his first name or his last, only that it was genuine. "I don't do funny names anymore," he said. "I'm headquarters now." He smiled. It was an ersatz smile, like his brief ersatz handshake. He suggested she come inside, and once again managed to leave the impression of sudden inspiration. "And you're Sarah," he informed her, as he conveyed her down the wide center hall. "Sarah Bancroft, a curator at the well-regarded Phillips Collection. Sarah Bancroft, who courageously offered us her services after 9/11, but was turned away and told she wasn't needed. How's your father?" She was taken aback by the sudden change in course.
"Do you know my father?"
"Never met him, actually. Works for Citicorp, doesn't he?"
"You know exactly who he works for. Why are you asking about my father?"
"Where is he these days? London? Brussels? Hong Kong?"
"Paris," she said. "It's his last post. He's retiring next year."
"And then he's coming home?"
She shook her head. "He's staying in Paris with his new wife. My parents divorced 2 years ago. My father remarried right away. He's a time-is-money sort of man."
"And your mother, where is she?"
"Manhattan."
"See your father much?
Holidays, weddings. The occasional awkward lunch when he's in town. My parents divorced badly. Everyone took sides, the children included."
"Why are you asking me these questions? What do you want from—" "You believe in that?" he asked, cutting her off.
"Believe in what?"
"Taking sides."
"Depends on the circumstances, I suppose. Is this part of the test? I thought I failed your test."
"You did," said Carter, "with flying colors." They entered the sitting room. It was furnished with the formal but anonymous elegance usually reserved for hotel hospitality suites. Carter helped her off with her coat and invited her to sit.
"So why am I back?"
"It's a fluid world, Sarah. Things change. So tell me something. Under what circumstances do you think it's right to take sides?"
"I haven't given it much thought."
"Sure you have," Carter said. And Sarah, for the second time, saw her grief counselor, sitting in his floral wing chair with his ceramic mug balanced on his knee, dully prodding her to visit places she'd rather not go. "Come on, Sarah," Carter was saying. "Give me just one example of when you believe it's all right to take sides."
"I believe in right and wrong," she said, lifting her chin a little. "Which probably explains why I flunked your little tests. Your world is shades of gray. I tend to be a bit too black and white."
"Is that what your father told you?"
No, she thought, it was Ben who accused her of that failing. "What's this all about?" she asked. "Why am I here?"
But Carter was still turning over the implications of her last response. "And what about the terrorists?" he asked, and once again it seemed to Sarah as if the thought had just popped into his head. "That's what I'm wondering about. How do they fit into Sarah Bancroft's world of right and wrong? Are they evil, or is their cause legitimate? Are we the innocent victims, or have we brought this calamity upon ourselves? Must we sit back and take it, or do we have the right to resist them with all the force and anger we can muster?"
"I'm an assistant curator at the Phillips Collection," she said. "Do you really want me to wax lyrical on the morals of counterterrorism?"
"Let's narrow the focus of our question, then. I always find that helpful. Let's take, for an example, the man who drove Ben's plane into the World Trade Center."
Carter paused.
"Remind me, Sarah, which plane was Ben on?"
"You know which plane he was on," she said.
he was on United Flight 175, which was piloted by Marwan Al-Shehhi. Suppose for a moment that Marwan Al-Shehhi had managed somehow to survive. I know it's crazy, Sarah, but play along with me for argument's sake. Suppose he managed to make his way back to Afghanistan or Pakistan or some other terrorist sanctuary. Suppose we knew where he was. Should we send the FBI with a warrant for his arrest, or should we deal with them in a more efficient manner? Men in black, special forces, a Hellfire missile fired from a plane without a pilot. I think you know what I would do to him. Suppose I'm interested in hearing it from your own lips before we go further. The terrorists have declared war on us, she said. They've attacked our cities, killed our citizens, and tried to disrupt the continuity of our government. So what should be done to them? They should be dealt with harshly. And what does that mean? Men in black, special forces, a Hellfire missile fired from a plane without a pilot. And what about a man who gives them money? Is he guilty too? And if so, to what degree? I suppose it depends on whether he knew what the money would be used for. And if he knew damned well what it would be used for, then he's as guilty as the man who flew the plane into the building. Would you feel comfortable, indeed justified, in operating against such an individual? I offered to help you 5 years ago, she said contentiously. You told me I wasn't qualified. You told me I wasn't suited for this sort of work. And now you want my help. Carter appeared unmoved by her protest. Sarah felt a sudden empathy for his wife. You offered to help us, and we treated you shabbily. I'm afraid that's what we do best. I suppose I could go on about how we were wrong. Perhaps I might try to soothe your feelings with an insincere apology, but frankly, Miss Bancroft, there isn't time. His voice contained an edge that had been absent before. So I suppose what I need now is a straight answer. Do you still feel like helping us? Do you want to fight the terrorists, or would you prefer to go on with your life and hope it never happens again? Fight? She asked. I'm sure you can find people better suited for that than me. There are different ways to fight them, Sarah. She hesitated. Carter filled the sudden silence by engaging in a prolonged study of his own hands. He wasn't the kind of man who asked things twice. In that regard, he was very much like her father. Yes, she said finally. I'd be willing. And what if it involved working with an intelligence service other than the Central Intelligence Agency? He asked, as though discussing an abstract theory. An intelligence service that is closely allied with us in this fight against the Islamic terrorists. And who might that be? Carter was good at evading questions. He proved it again now. There's someone I'd like you to meet. He's a serious chap, a little rough around the edges. He's going to ask you a few questions. Actually, he's going to put you under the lights for the next few hours. It's going to get rather personal at times. If he likes what he sees, he's going to ask you to help us in a very important endeavor. This endeavor is not without risk, but it's critical to the security of the United States, and it has the agency's full support. If you're interested, remain where you are. If not, walk out the door and we'll pretend you stumbled in here by mistake.
This is the end of disc number 4. Please insert disc number 5.